You are listening to Studying Pixels, an ultra-violent podcast on game studies and video game culture. I'm Stefan Heinrich Simond, I'm a game studies scholar from Germany.
I'm Dan Hughes, I'm a Japanese scholar from Texas.
And you can find us every Sunday on studyingpixels.com and wherever you get your podcast. The good old violent video game debate, that's going to be it for today. Memories.
Has this been around as long as video games have, this debate?
Not sure whether it's been around for as long as video games have been, because video games, technically you would say the 70s? Would you say the 70s, late 60s for video games?
I think so. Yeah, the danger of Pong. What is it teaching our children?
I think the big one was, though, and we addressed this in our ESRB episode, Mortal Kombat. I think that was the release of Mortal Kombat in 1994. That was the point where there was at least... No, wait, this was the second big discussion, because the first one was this car race, Carmageddon.
Oh, is that the one?
Game.
Okay, yeah. But, well, I know that the Mortal Kombat situation, that's the first time that it came in public view in a big way in the States anyway, because that was a whole congressional hearing about it, like we talked about in our ESRB episode.
Where it actually changed public discourse and where it changed some legitimate like policies on how to handle the matter. Whereas I think before it was always kind of just frowning and looking upon violence in video games and being like, oh, I'm not so sure about this.
Yeah.
But definitely Mortal Kombat made a big dent and led to the establishment of the ESRB, which we have discussed in our Plus episode on how the ESRB works. We can link that in the show notes. And I think that probably the most, for me, the most memorable one was around the late 90s and early 2000s in the wake of the Columbine High School massacre.
Oh, yeah.
That was something that had such a profound impact in Germany as well. Even though, I mean, school shootings. Do you say school shootings? Is that still legitimate terminology?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Unfortunately. Yeah, it's a pretty... common occurrence, I'm afraid to say, in the States.
It is still, isn't it?
Mass shootings, I think. I guess that's more of the common parlance now, because it's not always schools. Not to start so dour in this episode, but it is about violence, and this is a huge part of the culture in the States, I'm afraid. So yeah, mass shootings, big problem here. And I think, probably the one that shook the world, was Columbine back in the late 90s, like you said. So you said that was a big deal in Germany too.
It was a big deal in Germany, because it's kind of the debate swept over, especially when I think a year later there was one of the only, I don't want to be mistaken, but it's, or I might be mistaken here, but it's probably one of the only school shootings that ever happened in Germany. In like 2001, I think, in a place called Erfurt, there was also a kind of school massacre in Germany. Oh, wow. That's still like a huge public and cultural trauma. And in the wake of this entire thing, the school shootings and what is going on with our children, what's going on with the youths of this world, that people would do such a thing. It kind of fueled a moral panic that really went down hard when it comes to video games.
Well, I think that there's always a goal in sort of pointing the finger at something. What is the cause of this? If we can only excise this horrible thing that's led to this, then maybe this won't happen again. Not to get too political right out the gate here, but never seems to be about guns in the States. It's always about something else. I would say that the gun is a big part of the shooting, but whether it was sort of the satanic panic or, you know, heavy metal music.
Marilyn Manson games, and Slipknot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Man, they were big during the Columbine discussion.
Yeah. And I can tell you, I was like in the early 2000s, I was a teenager and I was listening to Marilyn Manson and Slipknot, and I loved playing, you know, Doom and Counter-Strike. It was really tough. It was a time, and this might be for, if you're a little bit younger and you haven't experienced that yourself, might hardly be imaginable, but when you brought up that you are playing video games in conversation, for example, then people would be genuinely worried and would be like,
"Yeah,
are you okay? It's like, are you sure this, you know, what's wrong?
Yeah.
Is something the matter? Do you want to talk about something?"
I think I had a bit of that too. It's, you always start on the back foot, especially when you're looking to, you know, when I was a kid, when I was referring to video games, I was referring to Pokemon and Mario and stuff like that. And so to have that reaction from people, it's like, no, wait a minute. It's not the old ultra violence that you're thinking that I'm engaging with here.
And even if it was, I think it was that time where for the first time I realized that the media and public discourse, that they are not always right. And that there are also deliberate attempts to spread lies. I distinctly remember how I played Counter-Strike a lot on LAN parties with friends and sometimes also online. I was in a Counter-Strike clan. And then we read in a newspaper, it's a Boulevard magazine, it's a terrible one, but unfortunately the most economically successful in Germany, the most widespread, it's called the Bild-Zeitung. And they had an article on Counter-Strike where they wrote how you get, in Counter-Strike, you get extra points for killing children and old ladies and such things, you know? People were just, you realize, like, they are just making stuff up, you know? They have no idea about this video game. They're just making stuff up to demonize it and to basically get people to push against it and to be upset. And this is something I realized at that age in that particular instance.
Ah, old Counter-Strike, killing children and old ladies. I believe that was on the cover of it. That was the selling point.
Yeah, we all know it's like counter-terrorists, terrorists, and old ladies with and old children.
Just with prams, just walking around.
Exactly. Well, that is exactly the topic that we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about ultra-violence in video games. And whether there's anything wrong with it. It's going to be a reading episode, and we're going to jump into it in just a moment. But before we do that, let me briefly tell you that if you like this show, and if you want to help us make it happen, then you can support us by becoming a Studying Pixels Plus member. Because you can then get all of our episodes entirely ad-free, and you can get a lovely sticker that says, "I am Studying Pixels Plus." Excuse me, I am studying Pixels, but I'm studying Pixels Plus. And it has a little mascot, Pixelcoom. It's very cute. Mm. It's a good sticker. And then you have access to all of our monthly episodes, plus episodes that we do. Sometimes they are about video game culture, some deep dives, and other times they are there to help you study and research. I thought maybe we could give a very brief overview of the episodes that we've done so far, because they are only 8 in number, but the entire catalog will be available to you if you choose to subscribe. And I'm just going to briefly read out the titles. They are pretty self-explanatory. We did the following: How Not to Write a Term Paper, How Yakuza Works, How the ESRB Works, 10 Tips to Nail Your Next Presentation, 10 Features That Should Be in Every Video Game, The Rise and Fall of Visceral Games, What Makes a Good Research Question, and The Tragic Death of the PS Vita. That is the most recent one, and every month we'll add another one to that roster. So isn't that cool? Every month, Studying Pixels Plus becomes a little bit more attractive. Wow,
that's
what
right.
A deal! If you're curious about it, then you can go to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It is time for some reading. We're going to look into David Waddington's article titled, it's a little bit of a longer title, Locating the Wrongness in Ultra-Violent Video Games. It's been published in Ethics and Information Technology in 2007. And I must say that this article is one with which I disagree to a certain extent. Like, you might hear throughout the course of this episode quite some statements that you might find intuitively disagreeable, and I totally understand because I disagree as well, but this is going to be the first part of a series in which we engage a little bit more with the subject of violence and the morality of violence. So we are going to have another reading episode coming up in which we also critically reflect on what is being said today. So what we say in this episode is not necessarily the end of the debate, it's rather the beginning.
And an important step too, I think, because I was reading this and I've engaged with this debate on a lot of different levels, in public, in private, but this article, I will say, David Waddington did, as much as I disagreed with a lot of the article, as you said, at the end of it, it did definitely make me reflect on where I stand in this debate. So I think that it's an important piece to understand the argument that's happening around violent video games. And if you're looking to engage in this argument, or if you find yourself talking to a relative or a friend who is kind of throwing a lot of these terms at you, I think this is a good way to situate yourself in your own beliefs.
Yeah, to understand also the argumentation that is often thrown at video games, because David Waddington very much sees a problem in ultra-violence in video games. He finds that to a certain degree wrong. Not because he just says, lol, I don't like it, because he actually is a professor in the Department of Education at Concordia University, and he specializes in the philosophy of education. So he has engaged with the subject on a moral, philosophical level. This means we're not going to talk about any kind of media effect experiments about, you know, whether it makes people like empirically more aggressive or something. But this is an article that looks at the matter from a moral, philosophical lens. And Waddington, he says at first that we have to state that virtual violence is not identical to real violence. That is something that I think everyone can agree on, because otherwise it would mean if you shoot someone, if you shoot a civilian in GTA 5, then the police could come over and you could be taken to jail if it was the same thing. And it's evidently not.
Right. I think a good place to start. It is not the same thing as actual violence.
Okay.
Thank you, David.
Let's lay that kind of foundation.
Yes.
But still, it might still feel wrong. That's the interesting point, because it might still be like you do something in a video game, you commit some kind of violent act, and you feel a little bit disgusted by it, or you feel like you shouldn't have done that, or you even feel like maybe you are in the situation that you ought to exert some violence and you don't want to because you feel like it's wrong. And that is exactly the question that David Waddington ponders. And we could look at this from, I think, let's split it up into three sections to go through this step by step. The first one is the application of utilitarianism. That's the first moral philosophical perspective that he applies. The second one is Kantian virtue ethics. So this would be the categorical imperative that we can then talk about. And the third one, I titled it Simulation Unease, because it is this kind of question of what makes virtual violence feel wrong, even though it's not real violence. So these would be like the three chapters of this main story. Shall we jump into utilitarianism first?
I thought you'd never ask. Jump into utilitarianism.
Finally, after episode 33... Finally, yes. We're introducing the concept of utilitarianism. Well, we can do this. We introduce it properly now so that we can refer back to it in future episodes as well, and just simply presume that all of you then know what utilitarianism is for all the years to come.
Mm.
So utilitarianism is the ethics of utility. That's where the word comes from, an ethics of usefulness. And it's the term is crucially coined by Jeremy Bentham, who was, I think, predominantly a lawyer and a philosopher. And the key idea of utilitarianism is that you determine whether something is morally wrong or morally right by checking whether it increases the overall happiness of people. So a simple example would be, let's say you murder someone because that person disagrees with you. You have a debate, someone is like, maybe you're a Democrat, the other person is a conservative, and so you choose to murder them. Now, the question is, it's just hypothetical example.
Yeah, just hypothetical, yeah.
Let's say someone would start introducing very strict abortion laws. No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to go there now. But let's say you murder someone for some random reason. Then if you look at this from a utilitarian standpoint, you want to ask, like, is this morally correct or is it not? And from a utilitarian standpoint, it is not, because you killing that person, that means, well, okay, so what's the benefit of it? The benefit might be that you feel more at ease with your opinion now because you don't have someone who disagrees with you. So you might even feel a kind of a relief over the anger that you had in that conversation, in that debate. Cool, so that's on the positive side. But on the negative side is that that person's life is eradicated. That person might also have other people that care about them that fall into deep grief. It might be a traumatic incident for many other people, maybe people who witness it, or maybe relatives of the victim that will be troubled and traumatized potentially for the rest of their life. And it might even cause a huge outcry where it's like Democrat randomly murders Republican, and then it's like an entire shift in the political landscape. So there are a lot of issues that weigh in on the negative side. And that's why, as obvious as it is, that's how the utilitarian reasoning would be. That's why you shouldn't just murder someone.
It's kind of like saying, all right, well, if I intuit that murder is wrong, then utilitarianism comes in and says, the reason behind the wrongness is because of the real world effect that action would have, right? So you're not only murdering this person and taking away their life, but you're also taking away any of the good that they may do in the future. Granted, you're also taking away the bad that they may do in the future, but the implications of all of the removal of that person's life is not good, ultimately.
Yeah, but this is exactly the thing. From a utilitarian standpoint, you look at the consequences and not at the action itself. Whether murdering in itself is right or wrong doesn't matter. The only question is, what are the effects, and are there more benefits than there are harms that are caused by this? There are some more contested questions. I mean, now we've chosen a very simplified example with randomly murdering someone, but let's say you have this classic, like, modification of a trolley problem where you are a doctor in a transplantation ward in a clinic, and you've got four patients that are dying because their organs are failing. Now, a young person comes into the clinic and all their organs are perfectly working. You know that if you were to take that young healthy person's organs, you could save four people. And just for the sake of argument, let's assume that you know for certain, because you're such a good surgeon, that these organs would work and that these people would have a long time to live still and would be happy and fine after the transplantation. Then there's a bit of an issue, because from a utilitarian standpoint, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you have the life of one person. On the other hand, you have the life of four people. So they weigh in more into this equation. But there are also other things that need to be considered, such as, for example, what if you did that? And then it gets publicly known that if you go to a clinic as a person, as a healthy person or as a young person, you might actually get murdered and they might take your organs, right? Yes. Suddenly no one wants to go to a clinic anymore. It causes a huge problem. So you need to then consider that as well. And that makes this what is called like a utilitarian calculus, that makes, or hedonistic calculus makes it very complicated.
Yes. If you want a good, are you familiar with the show, The Good Place, Stefan?
Unfortunately not.
No, it's a great show. So I won't get into it. It explores a lot of different moral philosophies, but the idea basically is, if we're looking at things from a utilitarian perspective, your life becomes kind of a nightmare because you're always doing that calculus and trying to decide what the best outcome is. And it gets really messy when you start adding in personal attachment to people, or you start learning more about a particular person who's who you may be affecting with this choice that you're making. So it's definitely an important way to look at things, but it gets really messy if you say I'm a utilitarian.
Yeah, it gets messy, and it goes against often our intuitions when it comes to how empathic we might feel or how troubled we might feel to do certain acts. Yet there are also very much prominent contemporary examples of utilitarianism. Utilitarianism can also mean effective altruism, which is something that's relatively common at the moment. The idea that if you donate, let's say you have $50 to donate, where do you donate it to? And according to utilitarian considerations, you should not donate it to, let's say, homeless people in your neighborhood. You should not donate it to people that are, you know, in the US or that are in Europe and that maybe, you know, have options to still fall into a social security system, even though they might obviously be in a terrible situation. But you should actually go for who on this planet is in the worst possible situation. Who needs it the very most? And those people you should donate to, and not the people in your vicinity. So there are many important aspects of utilitarianism, many that are to be criticized, and many that make it a very effective form of moral reasoning. And if we want to apply them to video games, Waddington says, we have to determine two aspects. One, if ultra-violent video games ought to be wrong according to utilitarian considerations, then they must pose some kind of risk to cause harm, right? They must have some kind of harmful effects, harmful consequences. And number two, that risk that they exert must be higher than the benefits that video games and ultra-violent video games bring about. Those are the two criteria. They must have a risk, and that risk must be higher than the benefits. Simple calculation.
Mm.
And he says, quote, any argument against violent video games on these grounds needs to show that there is a significant potential for an increase of risk, end quote. So what counts as a significant potential for an increase of risk? The thing is that, of course, it would be ideal for the moral argument here if we could safely determine whether playing violent video games makes you more aggressive or more violent or not. Unfortunately, this has been ongoing for years.
Yeah, this is the problem. One of the problems that I have with this article, right, is that, and I don't even know that he's doing this on purpose, but the idea is that this all presupposes that there is a negative outcome of violent video games. And he does kind of get into what he thinks the underlying problem may be a little later on. But maybe you can tell that when we're talking about utilitarianism and we're applying this kind of lens to violent video games, it does kind of assume that there is an outcome, and then that it is negative or that there is a risk involved with it, right? So the problem then becomes, well, is that present in every instance of a violent video game? And how can you measure that? Where does that go? There's all kinds of issues that come up.
Yeah, I think it gets very intricate at that point because it relies on empirical research that is not really conclusive.
Right.
I think from what I understand is that his argument is basically, so we were not able to determine a causal link between playing ultra-violent video games on the one hand and aggressive or violent behavior on the other. Like, we are investigating this, and there are some studies that come to the conclusion that there is a link, but it's like at most moderate one, not a necessarily significant one. Other studies say like there's absolutely no link. And overall, I think by now, this is 2022 now, the state of research is, it doesn't seem like there is any kind of link that is so significant that we need to be concerned about it. But Waddington says, we need to consider from a utilitarian perspective that it could be there. We don't know exactly. We can't exactly say that it doesn't exist. That's why we must factor it in as a potentiality. That's kind of the wobbly argument that this utilitarian consideration stands on.
it's sort of a weak basis for it. But I, to play devil's advocate, as much as I think the research would say that there is no link, you can't 100% say absolutely not, right? And so then the question becomes, well, looking at things on a case-by-case basis, how many utils or like units of utility are coming from each of these examples, right?
Yeah, and they become especially significant when you weigh them against one another. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, like we do know that the culprits who were involved in the Columbine High School massacre, that they drew direct references to Doom and such video games, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, hypothetically speaking, that if they wouldn't have been involved or engrossed in this world of playing Doom, playing other violent video games, that they might not have committed that massacre. We don't know that. That's a hypothetical assumption. But if we assume that made at least some kind of difference, then the risk, of course, and the negative consequences are tremendous, because that means that in the worst case scenario, that we will have actual mass shootings, that we will have people who will die, and the world will basically blow up in flames, because so many people play video games that it's only a matter of time until everyone goes around shooting everyone.
Right, right.
On the other hand, what are the benefits? Well, some people are enjoying it. That's kind of the argument that Waddington makes, you know? Some people are having fun doing this. And this is a really... This doesn't weigh in particularly heavily. Joy of doing this doesn't really count much when on the other side you have even a small chance of potentially even saving lives.
And that's maybe my broader issue with utilitarianism is the... I guess as a thought experiment, I understand the reasoning behind it. But I think that when it comes to real world examples, right, it is difficult to kind of pin down, all right, well, there's a 0.01% chance that there is this link and that we're all eventually going to engage in real life ultraviolence, right? Compared to, well, it's just entertainment. Or entertainment at the lightest, art at the heaviest, maybe. And to me, it's just there's a lot of footwork that you have to do to kind of get to that argument, and it doesn't hold up, especially nowadays. I think that we've had this argument for so long.
Yeah, it's so problematic, especially if you assume, you said like it's a 0.01% chance or something, yeah, that, let's say, something really seriously harmful comes about someone playing an ultra-violent video game. Well, at which degree do you factor in such, let's say, almost negligible possibilities? If you have a certain chance when you let people drive cars that someone is going to, as happened in Germany, drive into a Christmas market, for example, and commit a terrorist attack by doing so, then would that mean that, well, if you prohibit people from driving cars, well, then things go slower, but at least nobody dies. So, well, utilitarianism would come to the conclusion, you know, it's a little bit ridiculous because you can't factor in every single possibility and always assume the worst case, because that's just not how life actually works.
No, it's always looking backwards, I think, utilitarianism, which is the problem, because you can't, There's no equation that you can plug in to get the answer. It's only retrospectively that you say, well, that was good or that was bad. And that's fine. I think that's okay to do when you're when you are looking back on something, but it's hard to project arguments with utilitarianism, I think.
Yeah, that's true. It is probably quite a bit easier to do it in retrospect, to analyze arguments and ethical or moral reasonings rather than project into the future, especially since that hedonistic calculus of adding things up against one another, calculating, that is such a tough feat to accomplish. Even if you think about this video game example, Waddington on the positive side, he puts in joy. He says, like, people are enjoying this, but it doesn't weigh all that much. But he completely overlooks, you have hinted at that already, artistic expression is also worth something. There's also a huge video game industry that produces jobs, and there's a profound passion and happiness revolving around video game culture that is so widespread that it can't be underestimated. Just simply saying, okay, a couple of people enjoy it, that's maybe not really acknowledging the benefits and the positive effects in this case.
Precisely. And I think it's to just call it joy, I think, is undermining that, because, you know, take a game like the latest God of War, which I think is a beautiful artistic expression of how anger and violence can actually poison you, and you need to bring yourself out of that for others. We couldn't have had the most recent God of War without all of the preceding God of Wars that were all leading to this interesting argument. So then you break down, okay, even looking at a game like that, what is the utility of going through an evolution like that to come to the conclusion that violence is bad, right? Is it worth going on? I would say yes. The artistic expression of growing up with a game series like God of War and then seeing a character like Kratos becoming this caring father that he never had, I think that's a worthwhile artistic endeavor that you overlook if you say, well, it's just joy. It's just entertainment. Well, yeah. Not really. There was a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on, especially over time. This is what you emphasized already, that if you look at it from, if you look at the first three God of War games, then maybe you would be like, you would disapprove of them because they are ultra-violent, and we're using the term very liberally, ultra-violent. They are explicitly depicting violence. That would be the more accurate way to phrase it. But obviously you couldn't have known at that point that it would all lead to a kind of very empathic and intricate discussion of emotions, of the role of the father, and of the consequences of violence. Since you couldn't have known that, you couldn't have given a smart answer from utilitarian perspectives. But Waddington also says, he comes to the conclusion that he would be a bit cautious from a utilitarian standpoint, right? That's how I read it. He comes to the conclusion that because of all these possibilities and because there is no proven link between ultraviolence and video games on the one hand and violent actions on the other, because that link doesn't empirically, we haven't found it, we haven't been able to prove such a thing, that's why we can't really go all out and say, from a utilitarian perspective, ultraviolent video games are categorically bad.
So fair play to him, because it is. The utilitarian argument. You mentioned the trolley problem earlier. I guess I'm just at the point in my life where maybe 5 or 10 years ago I would have really wrestled with the trolley problem and thought to myself, "Wow, this is really big stuff." But now it's like, well, what the. One of my favorite things about that show, The Good Place, is that they're having a hypothetical argument about the trolley problem, and one of the characters says, why don't we just do it? And he makes it real, and then it all falls apart, because you can't just have this thought experiment when you're faced with a problem of, oh my God, what do I have to choose? So yeah. That's the utilitarian problem to me. And so fair play to Waddington. I think he kind of says, yeah, it's not the best way to look at everything.
I've seen that the correct answer to the trolley problem is actually that you have to wait until the first two wheels of the trolley are like over the intersection, and then you flick the switch so that the trolley goes sideways and brakes before even rolling over anyone.
Ah, but then then perhaps you run the risk of the trolley flipping over and
crushing
hitting both groups.
that's the ultra violent video gamer here giving an answer. How do I get both? How do I get maximum points? Do I get a trophy if I kill them all?
Maybe there's something to this after all.
Well, maybe we should move on with some Kantian considerations here.
Yes.
I love Immanuel Kant. I have to say that. I've written a term paper about Immanuel Kant once, about the possibility of the moral atheist. Can you be moral while being at the same time an atheist? A tip, I came to the conclusion, yes.
Well, I'm glad you gave us the answer.
Well, Immanuel Kant, he had a completely different perspective on the matter, and that is one of the categorical imperative which he coined. He's really not concerned with the consequences of an action. The consequences that utilitarianism is all about, they don't matter all that much for Immanuel Kant. Instead, what determines the moral status of an action is the intention behind it, or what he calls the maxime, the premise upon which you act. And in order to put this into a proper framework, he gave, I think, in total 4 phrasings of the categorical imperative. We're going to only engage with the first 2 because they are the most popular ones, but there are more. He went, had at it several times. And the thing is that we have to consider for Immanuel Kant, when he talks about the categorical imperative, then what he means is not like something that we might think is right or wrong, or something that is strongly implied, like you really should do that. But this is duty ethics. This is necessarily binding because it follows logically. He basically thought about morality as in, you can logically deduce the moral thing to do, the morally correct thing to do, and that's what the categorical imperative tries to do, a necessarily binding principle. The first formulation is the most popular one, and it goes as follows, quote, "Act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it become a universal law," end quote. Shall I read it again just to let it sink in a little bit?
Yeah, I think this is worth repeating.
Okay, here we go. "Act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it become a universal law," end quote. And by the way, the German translation of the English translation of Immanuel Kant is a lot easier to read than the German original. The German original text is so dense. It's really interesting. You can spend your whole life reading Immanuel Kant and trying to decipher what he's actually talking about.
I believe it. It's dense enough in English, I feel like.
Well, it's often broken down for the sake of simplicity into the golden rule. Basically, don't do upon others what you don't want to be done upon yourself, or treat others like you want to be treated.
Yeah, there's some intuitive morality that we have that says, I would not want this to happen to me, therefore it should not be done.
Exactly. And the thing is, if we take an example, such as stealing is a famous example that is used to illustrate this. Basically, the thing is not, what is the consequence of stealing? So it's not so much about, if you steal, then you're taking money from someone else, and then you have more money, and that's not fair, or that's all not relevant. The question is the maxim upon which you act. So if you steal because you want to have more money, because you are, let's say, quite a bit greedy, and you think you should be better off than others, then that will be the maxim of your action. And regardless of what it brings about, regardless of whether it makes you a lot happier than you were before, it is wrong. Because if you assume that that maxim, that premise, is universal law, then that means that everyone acts in accordance to the maxim that they shall be better off than others. And that would be then how the world works, which is in fact pretty much capitalism. But yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say that would be a miserable world, and then I thought to myself, oh wait a minute.
Oh wait. Where is this argument leading?
Yeah.
but this is basically the idea. And the second formulation gives it a little bit more spice, I think. It's not as popular as the first one and not as widely known, which is why we should definitely add it in here. So the second formulation of the categorical imperative is, quote, "So act that you use humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of any other, always at the same time as an end, never merely as a means," end quote. And that means that you should always consider the interests of other people. You should never use other people as tools.
Which I think, and I guess you can relate it back to, I would not want to be used as a tool, therefore I should not do this to other people, right? And I suppose when you mentioned your term paper, right? So the idea of morality from an atheistic lens, right? This idea, I think, the counter argument to a lot of what Kant says is that, well, there is some universal truth given to us by a God. And so these rules are dictated and therefore we should not do them, right? But Kant would argue, well, you don't need that because you can sit with yourself and think, I would not want to have anything stolen from me because that would be devastating. Therefore, I should not do that to others because I want to live in a world where we don't devastate each other, right? Likewise, I don't want to use this person in a way solely as like a means to an end, because I wouldn't feel good if that happened to me. So I'm going to treat others with respect, basically.
Exactly. Do I feel comfortable being entirely exploited? That's really the question.
Yeah.
No, of course not. And if you don't feel comfortable with that, then maybe you shouldn't enslave others. You know, slavery is a classic example of this, because slavery is literally the epitome of using someone else as a means and not as an end. That's always like, it's a little bit weirdly phrased, but as an end is kind of the goal of an action and the means is the way to get there. And using people as a means is using them as a tool. When you have a slave, then you're not considering their ends, their goals, what they want to do. You only use them as means, and that is very easy to reason from a categorical imperative standpoint, why it is morally wrong, why it's not acceptable. But if you think about video games now, things get a little bit more complicated, because the thing is, the important point that Waddington goes into here is in the second formulation, Kant says, whether in your own person or in the person of any other. So this means you should not only treat other people as ends and not merely as means, but also yourself. You have a moral obligation towards yourself, a moral duty, in fact, towards yourself to be virtuous. It's an obligation, it's a duty that you have to fulfill.
I think this comes from a place of there's this kind of idea, and I'm not a big Kantian scholar, but I think you can kind of reason that if you engage in, let's go back to stealing, if you engage in the act of stealing, you are harming other people, but the act of harm harms yourself, right? There's this sense that you have tarnished yourself in some way by engaging in this poor decision. And so Kant would say, well, it's not just others. You should also take care of yourself, basically, right?
Exactly. You should take care of yourself. You have an obligation to take care of yourself. You should not be cruel to others. You should not be gruesome to others. You should not torture others. That is exactly the argument that Waddington is harping on, because Kant says, you know, if we think about animals, the thing is, animals, for Kant, they don't really have a moral status in themselves because they are not humans. So they don't have any kind of moral rights. They don't have kind of a right for their well-being or something that is immediately tied to the categorical imperative, because they're not moral beings. But still, Kant says, and I guess he would have been beaten up if he said otherwise, we still should not torture animals. Animal cruelty is not acceptable, except for in some circumstances where it's necessary. For example, when it comes to, you know, research, or when it comes to eating animals so you can survive. But hunting, we should not otherwise be, yeah, hunting. We should otherwise not be cruel to animals, because that cruelty that, as you said, Dan, harms ourselves. It inflicts a certain harm upon the moral obligation that we have onto ourselves to be cruel and gruesome to animals. And Waddington says, well, maybe, quote, if animals can be said to be an analog of humanity, perhaps video game characters are as well. After all, video game characters are often representations of humans, end quote.
Now, this is where, because I must admit, I read this with a bit of a chip on my shoulder, right? Because this, the violence in video games argument is, to me, very tired. It's like treading old ground. But this was a point that I found myself thinking about really intensely, because I've written before about how I think that I feel we owe something to characters in a video game, where I've talked before about in Kingdom Hearts, there are characters who are shown to, they're told to, it's told to us that they have no emotion, and yet we see them emote. And so to me, that brings up this argument of, what am I doing to these characters by engaging with this story? And so that quote that you just read really made me sit and think, well, what am I doing when I engage in violent acts in a video game? Because I think it is a harsh example, but it's one worth examining, that there is an analog between hurting an animal with no point of, you know, with no intent of hunting or eating it, and just like killing an NPC for fun. It may be weak, but there is something there, and I think that that's worth looking at.
It's something that ties back to ourselves and our relations that we relation that we have with these other, let's say, beings. Because even though, I mean, I would say there is a very fundamental difference between animals and video game characters, namely the first one being like, they're alive.
They're real.
Yeah. Video game characters arguably are not. Otherwise, I get when you say like we have a certain, we might have a certain obligation towards characters in video games, but not in a sense like we do towards other people in daily life, because otherwise it would be like morally wrong if we don't play the game or don't finish the game because we haven't finished the arc, right? It has a different moral status. But still, there is an eeriness that remains behind when you think, well, they are, might not be real, but they are very much simulated to the degree that they might be. And what does it say about ourselves and the relationship that we have with our own virtues if we enjoy harming them?
Yes. So this is where I would say the self-reflection comes into it. And I think I'm much more inclined to agree with this sort of Kantian view. But again, it's not really perfect, because as you say, video game characters aren't real like a rabbit is, you know?
At least, though, harming video game characters does not bring about any good. It does not do anything good. It does not help us hone our kind of moral or virtuous integrity, and does not help us practice the categorical imperative. Therefore, there's nothing really good about playing ultra-violent video games. And I know that this argument is so deeply flawed. I actually wholeheartedly disagree with that, because I think what Kant actually means with a duty towards ourselves, something that's very different than what Waddington argues. But I just want to basically make that point, sharpen that point, so that we can address it in the future, because this is a very common argument, basically. It's like, well, of course, the character on the screen, the civilian that walks around in GTA 5, of course, that's not a real person. But what does it say about you that you enjoy running them over?
Yeah, I think the important takeaway from this section is that when looking at this argument, this is the first time I've said, okay, well, all right, there's something there. There's a kernel there, actually. We should look at that.
Something is there, and that's actually also where Waddington changes gears a little bit.
Mm.
Because so far, what Waddington said was very much oriented towards a normative perspective. Waddington was trying to determine, by applying utilitarianism and Kantian duty ethics, whether enjoying ultraviolent video games is morally wrong. Now he shifts gears and he says, well, okay, we can't quite determine that for sure, but we can try and understand why it feels wrong. Why does it feel so weird when we maybe run over characters in GTA 5 or when we see someone doing that and we feel just like a little bit, is that really necessary? Like, when I play Elden Ring, which I still do with great joy, and there are enemies that actually do not harm you. As soon as you trigger them, they just basically turn around and run. And then I leap after them and split them in half with my katana. And I think, what have I just done?
Yes.
I don't know about myself anymore. Something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm literally tarnished now. You used that word before in this episode. <Yeah. laughs> And this is what Waddington calls simulation unease. Because the thing is, it is deeply unsettling to us when we do not know whether a morally virtuous act is authentic or whether it is fake. When we don't know whether someone is actually, let's say, a very believable, morally virtuous person, or whether they actually have some kind of hidden side to them that is very scary and terrible. That's why he says, quote, "Indeed, the suspicion that our models of virtue may not be virtuous pervades our society. The press takes great delight whenever a supposed pillar of the community is toppled," end quote.
And this, I think, is a synthesis of the two things, utilitarianism and the categorical imperative, which is this fear I think we all have that is, okay, well, if I'm not looking at the consequences of an action, but I am looking at the kind of moral imperative behind it, what if a person is lying about having that moral imperative, right? This fear that there is no deep down, or there is no, I meant well behind it. They may have not meant well. Or what if we can't make the distinction? That's a scary thought. And I think when we play a video game and we engage in certain acts of violence, that question comes up for ourselves. Like, what did I really mean to do here, right?
Do you know the most terrible example of this? Kevin Spacey.
Oh, dear.
I don't know whether you remember this, but Kevin Spacey, former star of House of Cards, the American adaptation, basically left the show ungracefully after there had been some reveals about his past that he had relations, I think, with a minor, or he molested like a minor, I think a boy. And then his response to that was kind of like having his coming out, which was kind of very off, because people said, like, well, nobody cares whether you're gay or not. You've actually molested someone. Like, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he took the most terrible step he could possibly have taken. He went away for a while, and he went in his, I think he said, like, he's going to go in therapy and so on. And then he appeared all of a sudden again in a video where he played the role of Frank Underwood, a terrible, scary, creepy, and morally corrupt character, arguing that he should be re-employed on the show. He deliberately, if we employ this framework, he deliberately caused that unease. He deliberately blurred the lines of his wrongdoings and the wrongdoings that were obviously fake of his character that he played. And I just saw that video and I thought, why would you do that? It's like, people are going to hate you more if you do that, you know?
The levels of duplicity and subterfuge and Janice two-facedness. I mean, the video is called Let Me Be Frank. You can dissect the gross meaning of all, it just is a perfect, you're so right to bring that up. It's a perfect example of this horrible feeling that you get where you look at someone and you're like, what is your intention, you creep? I don't understand what you're doing.
Because the thing is, I can, like, it's totally fair that when you are an actor and you play a character that does terrible things, wonderful. enjoy, you know? That's sure. why you're an actor. Yeah. Enjoy, even though if you see the actor who played, let's say, Joffrey from Game of Thrones on the street, you might think like, oh God, that's that dude. But no, actually he's not. It was all just acting. But if you then mix it in with something that is authentic, that is real, that is an actual crime, that's the most stupid PR move you can possibly do. The thing is that this is exacerbated, this kind of unease of we don't know whether it's real or not. It's exacerbated by the fact that we don't know anymore as a society whether bad people will actually be punished and whether good people will actually be rewarded. This is something that brings us back to this question of the moral atheist. I did not intend for this to come up ever again on the show. It was just a weird anecdote. But indeed, it's very befitting because the reason why, when you're a firm believer in heaven and hell, then you have this kind of idea that good people go to heaven, bad people go to hell, and all is well. This is how it's supposed to be, and this motivates me to be good because, hey, I want to definitely go to heaven. Now, we don't know anymore in this day and age whether this is actually true. It's kind of been debunked as a myth. I don't want to disillusion anyone, but I'm not so sure whether this actually is what's going to happen after we pass on. And that's what makes it even more frightening, because we can't tell whether someone is truly good or not. And that's what Waddington applies to video games when he says, we kind of have this constant play pretend of committing violent acts. We constantly pretend that we run around an open world and we smash everything to pieces. We pretend that we chainsaw people into small pieces. Whatever. There's a whole lot of stuff going on in video games that we shoot people. We constantly shoot. How many times do we shoot guns in video games? Often at people that are labeled as being bad guys and so on. But yeah, we constantly shoot at other people. And it kind of causes this weird, this eerie unease. That's like, how many times do you basically have to shoot at a virtual character for it to have an impact on how you feel when you shoot at a real person?
Well, and there's a couple of things I want to dissect here, because he does make the difference in saying that right now, he says right now, back in 2007, the depictions of violence are kind of crude. And so there is a level of distinction. But he says, in a kind of cautionary way, when we get to the Jean Baudrillard Matrix version of reality where it's indistinguishable between simulation and reality, that's going to be really hard to parse. And I think it's maybe a more apt argument to make now, because things do seem a bit more realistic, I suppose you could say. You know, technology and video games has come a long way since 2007. And I think what he's getting at, and I want to be charitable to this argument, because I do, again, I think there is a kernel of something here. It's not that he's saying engaging with violent video games will make you stupid and believe that reality is fiction and vice versa. He's not making that argument. He's saying that the barrier weakens when we engage in this to a degree that is worth scrutiny and kind of worth being worried about. Because this is, I think, where the argument of being desensitized to violence comes in. If you, as you say, Stefan, are shooting a gun every day in a video game, you may be more likely to say, well, I want to shoot a real gun, right? Does that mean you're going to say, I'm going to kill people? Probably not. But you may be more intrigued to go and learn about real guns because of your interaction with video game weapons.
Yeah, and as silly the argument is that video games basically train you to engage with weapons, I always found that argument to be rather silly, because of course I can't handle an actual shotgun. It would probably just fly out of my hand and hit me in the head and then I would probably be unconscious.
Yeah.
But I do remember that, you know, these festival booths, these carnival booths where you can like shoot to get some plushies. Fire like a gun. I did that. I mean, as you can imagine, in Germany, I don't have many occasions to ever see even a real gun. It doesn't happen around these parts. But I had this wooden rifle in my hand, and I was just, it was just for this carnival. And I started shooting at these tiny painted ducks. And I realized, wow, I'm surprisingly good at this. And someone asked me, standing next to me, like, have you trained this? And I'm like, I've been
played a lot of many video games.
Played lots of Counter-Strike and listened to Marilyn Manson. And then he's like, whoa. So I think there is something that, yes, of course, it might be, it is all simulation and play pretend. But of course, I learn a little bit about how to aim down the sights, for example. I learn from more simulation-heavy games that I ought to fully exhale before I fire a shot so that my fingers are still as they possibly can be.
Mm.
And I also might, and this is just something like a speculation, I might be a little bit desensitized to the fact that if someone were to approach me and if I was in any danger and I had a gun on me, that I might even be even the slightest more willing to use it than someone who has never played around with a virtual gun. And what does this mean when you have like AR and VR technology, right? This is like going forward when you actually draw the gun from your hip and you actually have to aim down the sights and you have to reload your magazine properly and so on. The closer this gets to the real act, the more eerie the simulation unease.
I think this is the important thing to take away from this, because I want to make very clear, we're not agreeing with an argument that, you know, video games lead to real world violence. I don't think that's the takeaway here. I think that you could supplant violence for anything else with this simulation unease, and it would be just as true, right? So if you play a game, for example, where you're learning how to cook, right? It may be the case that you find that your cooking skills improve, or, you know, it could go in any direction here. And that is not as scary because cooking is good and fun, right? But
yeah.
violence is a little murkier. And I think that I'm reminded of, there's a Kurt Vonnegut novel called Mother Night. And the point of the novel, without going into detail in the story, is basically we should be careful about the roles that we play, lest we become the role. And I do think that there is some historical precedent for eventually you wear a mask so long that it's a distinction without a difference, right? And I think what Waddington is getting at here is that we should at least think about that with violence in video games, because there is some potential for it becoming more normalized than it may have been otherwise. Whether you agree with that or not, I think that's a whole other argument, but I do think that's the takeaway from this whole article for me.
I think that's definitely his strongest case that he's making here. Although I must say, I find this most interesting from the angle of descriptive ethics, where it's not so much about, so does that mean it is right or wrong? But simulation unease helps us understand why people might feel that it's right or wrong. Basically, what Waddington is doing here in my mind is he's explaining the bystander effect. The effect,
oh, yeah.
I don't know whether this is correct terminology. In German, it's like Beifahrer, where it's like, you know, you're driving along. Or when you basically just, or the backseat, that's it.
Yeah.
Right. The backseat argument. When you're sitting next to someone who plays a game and you're observing what they are doing, and then you might feel this kind of simulation unease more strongly so than they are, because while they are engrossed in a game and they know exactly the functions of everything, if you look at someone playing Doom without knowing Doom, I'm talking about Doom Eternal, modern Doom game, contemporary Doom game, then the only thing you see is someone raging around slaughtering demons with blood and gore splattering across the screen for like 18 hours, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you might think, wow, this is really terrible. So I think this idea of simulation unease, it explains the eerie sensation that a backseat gamer would experience, or a parent would experience, coming into the room of a child, looking at the screen, being like, oh my God!
That's such a good point, because What you just described, I think, is the feeling that everyone has who engages with this argument, which is that's not what I'm doing at all. You have an idea of what I'm doing. I have an idea of what I'm doing, and never the twain shall meet until you do what I'm doing. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because you think, like you see someone slaughtering around a city or running over passers-by, and then what you're actually doing is you're testing the limits of a play space. You're basically just experimenting and see how long can I survive while being hunted, which is not that much different than playing basically, you know, playing catch outside, where it's just like, how long can I evade others and still, you know, keep my run going. It's like,
do you think there's any credence to the idea that, you know, when you have a bit of plastic wrap and you move your hand over it and it makes that horrible screeching sound, and when you're doing it, it doesn't bother you, but when someone else is in the room, they say, "Can you please stop that? It's driving me insane."
Exactly, because you are in control and you know what you're doing. You can stop it at any point, but I can't stop you at any point.
We've hit on, okay, the saran wrap theory of Waddington here.
it is, I think, the strongest point, even though Waddington might not have necessarily intended it to be that.
Yeah.
But the simulation unease is exactly what I think changes the framework for someone who's not actually playing in the moment. And it's this kind of description of what's happening in this, what's driving this moral panic revolving around violence in video games. Wow, this has been quite a ride. And you have to consider, this is only part one.
Yes.
Because in our next reading episode, we might well read an article, I've got one in mind already, and we would argue exactly the opposite of what we argue today. But that's also important.
Yeah, and important to understand these arguments, I think, from all sides, so that you are more well-informed on the discourse. Because otherwise, you may have a feeling that you disagree with something, but you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't know why. And here we are kind of going into, let's steel man these ideas and look into them so that we can tear them down later.
We can tear them down, and we can also learn some stuff that might not have been necessarily the intention, such as the simulation unease idea. So what do you think about this? What is your intuition when it comes to the simulation unease? Does the idea convince you that this might be exactly the concept of the, well, I'm not going to say bystander, I'm going to say backseat. Shall I say backseat effect? Or is it bystander effect is something else, right?
Yeah, bystander effect is, I think, you don't engage with something. I think backseat effect is much, much more apt for this, yeah.
Exactly. The simulation unease, does that equate the backseat effect? And have you ever experienced that? Please let us know by writing in to podcast@studyingpixels.com. And while you do that, we're going to move ahead and do some side questing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken.
Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
As you know, in our side quests, we venture through the internet to bring you stories and articles that we find interesting and relevant. We also talk about our own impressions of games we are currently playing, and you can find everything that we talk about linked in the show notes. Number one, Microsoft's dodgy DRM comes into the limelight and no one's smiling. By Martin Robinson on Eurogamer.net. It's such a scary headline.
What a mess. What an absolute mess.
The thing is that, first of all, maybe as a background information, we do have to consider that when Microsoft first announced its Xbox One, there was a huge outcry because Microsoft had announced originally that the Xbox One would have to be always online. And it had this intricate system for how you can share games, and it would constantly check on whether the copy of that you're playing of a game right now is actually yours. It would perform a DRM check, a digital rights management check. Now, they basically went back on that and they made a big turnaround and they said like, no, it was all just a joke. After Sony had clearly taken them over several laps, they said like, no, we're going to do this completely differently. It's all fine. It's actually going to be just like with the PlayStation, only better. However, wink, as it turns out, this last weekend, Microsoft servers experienced some outages. And that in itself is not that much of a problem. It happens, you know, can happen to anyone. But it turns out that as these Microsoft servers went down, that quite some people were unable to play their games. And that includes games that they had downloaded already, as well as games that they physically own. So actual discs that people had purchased. This is, I want to be fair here because people know that I'm a Sony pony, so I need to be especially cautious when talking negatively about Microsoft. This is not an issue exclusive to Microsoft. We know that as Gran Turismo 7 launched on Sony's PlayStation, they also had a disastrous launch because the servers were down in the first couple of days and people couldn't play the game. And for some reason, Gran Turismo demands that you are always online. Now, the thing is, though, what happens in the background is exactly a DRM check. This is why you need to be online. The servers are performing a check. Is the copy that you own legitimate? And if it either is not legitimate, you get kicked out, or if the check fails or doesn't run, then you can't start the game. And this caused quite some problems. People were asking, interesting, I thought you had abandoned this idea. So what exactly is the DRM policy in place? How frequently does Microsoft check on the copies of the games that we own? And is it even possible at all to basically have an Xbox One, Xbox Series S or Series X and play entirely offline? Does that even work? Or will the console just lock us out because it can't check the legitimacy of the copy? That's basically the whole story, except for that afterwards, as this entire controversy was ongoing, Microsoft released a statement on Twitter and they said that there would be, quote, a full mitigation, end quote, over the next coming days, that they would introduce some sort of update. But as of yet, we do not know what this update will entail and whether it will potentially remove some DRM checks that have been implemented secretly.
I think that I understand DRM checks, I suppose, like in the digital age that we live in. But here's a big problem with it. It's all of a sudden millions of people are locked out of their gaming console. So I don't know. It seems like if your intent is to have a machine that plays video games, the first thing it should do is play video games at any point in time.
Yeah, it is, though, as a concept as such, I think a little bit intrusive, this kind of idea of not only am I going to check, like, I understand if you maybe have to activate a copy once. Fair enough.
Sure.
If that's what you need to do, fine. I think this has been around for many years that you have some kind of activation key that can only be used once. And of course, if you download a copy, you can only download it to your own account. And that account must be activated on a console. I understand all of that. But this idea of constantly checking in on users, it's too intrusive. It's like, hey, I purchased this game. I used it before. You can see that I've logged in before and it was a legitimate copy. Why do I need to constantly prove now? Why am I in a situation of having to prove persistently that I still own a legitimate copy?
It just doesn't make any sense. Like at that point, what does Microsoft think is happening? That you're buying genuinely, legitimately purchase a video game, and then you say, and now I will pirate it and log in with my pirated copy every time. It doesn't make any sense. So I honestly wouldn't be surprised if there is no nefarious thought behind this and it's just a stupid mistake. Because that almost feels exactly like what it is.
That's most likely the case. They probably just implemented this at some point and it was active all this time and nobody noticed because there was no major server outage, which is also, I mean, good on Microsoft that they didn't have such outages, but now suddenly people are drawing it into the spotlight and are saying like, hey, what's going on? Again, we might have to update you on what exactly has happened and how this situation has been resolved in the coming weeks, because for now, we don't know exactly what kind of update this will be. So we'll basically stay in tune with that particular story. Number two.
I wish that Konami and Silent Hill, I love it so much. I wish that we had a tombstone for it. So that we knew it was dead, because all of these rumors, my poor old heart, I can't take it stuff from. So there was a recent leak that came out, and you might be saying, okay, there's leaks all the time about video games. Why would this matter any differently, especially for Silent Hill, which is a series that has had so many hints and hopes and dreams associated with its return. So there were a couple of images that leaked, and they did look very Silent Hill-y, to be fair. I mean, there was, you can still find them in some places online, but they looked like, you know, the other world of Silent Hill. There was a character that had some tattoos or writing on her face or something, thought to be a main character. And there was people on Twitter who thought, oh, these images look like a Silent Hill leak. Maybe that's true. But obviously that could happen anywhere, anytime. The big difference here is that Konami enacted a copyright claim on those images and had them striked from Twitter, had them removed. There's a DMCA copyright takedown. So the idea now, very suspicious. And so this article that I've chosen that's talked about it is from a website called Xfire by Ray Ampolocchio, I hope I've pronounced that right, Ray. He's basically making the argument that DMCA takedown seems to have all but confirmed that is what it is. Because if these weren't legitimate, why would Konami care? Now, Konami has its own weird practices, so I wouldn't necessarily put it past them to strike down an image that was thought to be proprietary to them. But I do agree that it gives some legitimacy that while it may not be a Silent Hill leak, maybe it's some kind of project that Konami's working on. So at the very least, that seems real to me. If it's a Silent Hill game, I can only dream. In my restless dreams, I see that game.
Could it maybe be a possibility that image was not from a game that is currently in production, but that has been in production in the past and that was canceled?
There's some thought behind that, because it seems like these images were from 2020. So either that was from a game that's been in production for a few years, which would be, I guess, good for whatever game it is. It's been worked on for a while. Or like you say, this is something that was maybe in the works that they shut down. They never talked about, they never released any press for it. And they just want that removed because it doesn't exist anymore.
Why is Konami still sitting on that Silent Hill license?
That's the thing. They release merchandise for it. They have their pachinko machines in Japan that are huge. So that may be the answer.
Are those Silent Hill pachinko machines?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Because I guess that's where Konami's properties go to die. Pachinko machines. Where other companies do like pay to win, Konami does pachinko parlors.
Whatever floats your boat. But I think,
I guess so.
My idea was, and I think we spoke about that in one of our episodes, in the mashup episodes, I think they should just give up that license. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that my suggestion was to basically now sell it to Microsoft in this case and have Ninja Theory work on it, who are currently working on Hellblade 2, and make a proper nice Silent Hill game. Because I have this feeling we've got these constant weird teasers. Also, you remember Hideo Kojima and Guillermo del Toro, who kind of were like, oh, it would be cool if someone made a video game about this, you know? And it's like, what are you saying?
stop turning the dagger in my chest.
Yes.
And at this point, I almost, I don't know, between this and then the Abandoned controversy, if you remember that, there's a game called Abandoned that people thought was a Silent Hill title, and then it's just a game that these developers are creating. I think, I don't know, it's do something with it, Konami, or just let it come out and say it's just pachinko now. One way or the other.
Maybe it would also be important to acknowledge that Silent Hill, while, yes, legally owned by Konami, it is a series that many people have fond memories of, that many people are attached to, and they have a genuine interest in this, in the story of Silent Hill and the events that take place there. There is an investment, and these games often mean a lot to people, including the PT, the preview teaser, which never made it into a fully fleshed game, but was supposed to be before this big Kojima fallout happened. I think there is a legitimate argument to say at a certain point, just give up on it. They can't be those Silent Hill pachinko machines. They can't make you that much money, can they? I mean, people don't go to a pachinko machine, play it because it's Silent Hill print on it.
Yeah. So it would be cool, but I'm not holding my breath. And I think, to me, this whole leak just speaks more to Konami as a, speaking of morals, a morally bankrupt company that has been playing with my heart for decades at this point.
Ah, morally bankrupt companies that are playing with our hearts. That brings us to number three. After a 2-year absence, it's been 2 years already. After a 2-year absence, Fortnite is back on iPhones, but not on the App Store. This is an article on businessinsider.co written by Ben Gilbert. Fortnite has been off of the App Store for quite a while now. We reported on this, but in brief, Epic Games included an alternative payment method for players to purchase in-game currency. And that violated Apple's policy and circumvented them from receiving a share of every transaction. Because if you're on the App Store, then you need to give, I think at that point it was still 30% of every transaction to Apple. However, if you have your in-app transaction system, then Apple won't ever know of how much is being purchased. So promptly, Fortnite, as well as all other Epic Games products, were ejected from the App Store. And ever since then, there's an ongoing legal battle. And eventually, this lawsuit will determine whether Apple has to allow third-party storefronts on their App Store. For now, though, Fortnite did return through the back door. Because introducing Microsoft and the Xbox Game Pass. While Fortnite can't be on the App Store because Apple won't allow it, it has been included now in Microsoft's Xbox Game Pass. So that means if you want to play Fortnite on an Apple device, on iPhone or an iPad, you can download the Xbox app and you can create an account, which is free. And since Fortnite is a free-to-play game, you can run and play it. However, you must keep in mind that it is a stream. This is a streamed game. It's not running on the device itself. But that's basically, except for the fact that you need to have a stable internet connection, which I assume you want anyway if you play Fortnite, because it's kind of an online game.
Kind of.
then you could say Fortnite has basically been brought back.
But not deliberately, right? It's not like Epic Games said, we shall do this.
No.
Back on the App Store.
I don't think it's that there's any insidious.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing insidious about it. It's just been included in the Xbox Game Pass. And because the Xbox Game Pass is available on iPhones and iPads and so on, that's how it basically came back. Yeah, that's true.
Wouldn't that be funny if in this ongoing legal argument that's going on, they somehow implicate Microsoft?
And then it's just like everyone sues everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Why it's not?
A never-ending legal battle and Disney laughing in the background, just waiting.
Yeah. Then Apple bans Microsoft off the store because they are not allowed to have like in-app streaming, because that's only for Apple. And then Microsoft is suing Apple, and then Apple is suing Microsoft back because they're kind of forcing the Microsoft Office on all kinds of Apple devices and are trying to do that. And suddenly everyone sues everyone.
An Ouroboros of legal of legal problems.
And then Microsoft sues Epic Games because, yeah, it's... and then Activision comes along.
Yes. And,
Activision shareholders agreed, the majority agreed to the Microsoft takeover. We haven't reported on that, but it is indeed the case.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, the majority agreed, yeah. And this takeover is going to go ahead now. I think if there are no legal reasons such as cartel concerns so that there should be any problem. I mean, yeah, this can happen, but it's not very likely because it's a different form of integration. Like it's a form of vertical integration, not horizontal integration, and therefore it should not be a problem.
What a weird world we live in, Stefan. Do you ever think about and not to get too nostalgic here, but do you ever think about the late 90s, early 2000s and just think, back when you had a LAN party, you were killing old ladies and children in Counter-Strike.
Yeah, I remember that. The times when I was shooting people in Age of Empires.
That's right.
Those were the days.
Those were the days.
The days when such ultra-violent games like World of Warcraft came out.
Ah, yes. And nothing ever bad ever happened again with Activision, Blizzard, or any of its subsidiaries.
Yes. What Activision, Blizzard... honestly, it is astonishing that for so many years, Activision, Blizzard was always this company where you had the impression they're a little bit like Rockstar Games. They take a long time to develop video games, and then after many, many years, they come out, and it's always like reliably good. And I think then came Diablo 3, and that I think put a proper dent into it with their kind of auction house that they tried to implement.
Yeah.
Where you could sell in-game items, and everyone was like, we don't really want that, you know? And they were like, oh, is that true? Well, then we're going to take it back, you know?
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, CD Projekt Red, like all of these golden children, they get put up on a pedestal, and then it comes out that no one is perfect, and there's a lot of problems all over the place, and now Apple and Microsoft and Epic and Activision are all suing each other in this never-ending legal battle that we've described. So,
who's the golden child of video games at the moment? Like, which kind of developer or publisher is the one where everyone is always like, wow, maybe Annapurna Interactive?
I think Annapurna, yeah.
Or Devolver Digital, like the underdogs.
Ooh.
Everyone loves to Devolver, root for an underdog.
Devolver's kind of been knocked out because people aren't super fans of Trek to Yomi.
That's true.
Yeah. Yep. So maybe Annapurna for now.
maybe Annapurna Interactive, the kind of thing where whenever the Annapurna Interactive logo shows up and people that know, like, enjoy video games quite passionately, everyone's like, oh, cool, that's surely going to be interesting.
This will be good
in some way.
Well, Annapurna, we look forward to your downfall, I suppose. Is what we're getting.
Sitting and waiting. Well, thank you so very much for listening to this episode. If you want to support us and get Studying Pixels Plus, then you can do that by going to studyingpixels.com/plus. And we'll talk again next week. See you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.